That surplus means we will not have to draw on our savings in 2010 or 2011. But it does not mean we should wildly spend more money.
Governor Parnell releases his budget proposal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 14th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, in the line at the Sarah Palin book signing.
Ah, this is such a phenomenal human experience. How would you want to miss it?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
Governor Parnell today gave the public its first look at the budget that will be before the legislature during next year's session. He is proposing to spend $4.7 billion in state general funds on operating expenses and $309 million on capital projects. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
In presenting the plan to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, the governor said he wants to follow the Constitution's priorities of public safety, education, and transportation.
First, we're going to maintain budget discipline by limiting state agency growth. Second, we're going to focus on results for Alaskans. And third, we're going to take the long-term view. We're not in this for the short term as Alaskans. We're in this for our future. And so how does this budget compare to last year's? I get to tell you straight up, this year's budget leaves a surplus in savings when we're done and is higher than last year's budget.
The governor repeated priorities he's already outlined in previous statements. He'll increase funding for education, include money for a merit-based scholarship program for high school graduates, increase the number of public safety officers, continue revenue sharing for the state's municipalities, build a crime lab, provide major maintenance for the Dalton Highway, and build a road to Umiat. And with it all, the governor says there's still money to save.
Just last week, the state's revenue forecast was announced, and we anticipate having a surplus for the current fiscal year and a surplus in 2011. That's because the price of oil went up from last year. $1.56 billion more revenue than expected in 2010, and $1.36 billion more revenue for 2011 than projected last spring. That surplus means we will not have to draw on our savings in 2010 or 2011. But it does not mean we should wildly spend more money. Instead, we should save most of this surplus.
In a meeting with reporters following his speech, Parnell admitted that he expects the budget numbers to change during the legislative session. He says it's the nature of the legislature. For the capital budget, for example, Parnell says he received $1.9 billion in requests for local projects, and he approved only $309 million.
I need to leave room for legislators to fight for their districts and to work with them in this legislative process. That's what this budget is designed to do. And you're going to see those kinds of projects all around the state. There are important projects that are priorities for me and for legislators, but that's part of the ongoing discussion for the session.
It's premature to forecast what the governor's budget will look like when the session ends next year, but House Finance Co-Chair Mike Honker says it's a luxury to have enough money to spend all you want and to save some, too. He does say the governor's laid out clear objectives and provides the foundation for a discussion of the relationship between the state's priorities and resources.
I think the backdrop to the entire budget conversation this year is going to be a discussion of how can we sustain the level of expenditure at this state that we have reached in the face of the accelerating rate of production decline in our major oil fields. That backdrop is, I think, going to be a very critical part of the conversations this year.
The budget will be introduced at the start of the session that begins January 19th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaskans with military ID cards waited hours in line yesterday for the chance to have Sarah Palin sign a copy of her book, Going Rogue. Events at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage and Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks were billed as the last stops of her nationwide tour, but now she's promising to hold another signing in Alaska that's open to the public. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The line snaked up and down the long hallway of the Elmendorf Mall and then took over the food court. Getting a spot up front required dedication. Determined autograph seekers arrived as early as 6:30 a.m. for the noon event. Bill Jamison was not in that group. He was way in the back of the line near the soda fountain. But the philosophy professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage was philosophical about the long wait.
Ah, this is such a phenomenal human experience. It's fun. How would you want to miss it?
Most people in line seemed to share that attitude. They held copies of the book and talked with friends. Carol Milkman had waited more than 5 hours by the time she neared the front of the line, but she said the time was going pretty fast.
You look like you came prepared.
I did. I did, yes. I just brought food, water, and books and a chair, or a step stool.
Milkman says she wouldn't have missed the event for anything. She worked on Palin's gubernatorial and vice presidential campaigns. She says Palin has one quality that makes it easy for her to connect with people.
Her honesty. I think she's honest, and I think she stands for a lot of values that Americans have, and she's not afraid to speak out on them.
The Air Force estimated there were 2,000 people in the crowd. 100 soldiers in military uniforms worked security at the event. A half dozen were charged with guarding the two layers of ropes that separated Palin from everyone except the next person in line. Palin greeted each person warmly as she signed books with a red Sharpie.
Hi, what's your name?
Many people were meeting Palin for the first time, but some old friends of the former governor also attended the event. Jackie Kahn was one of the few people in the crowd who wasn't just holding the book, but actually in it. Kahn played basketball with Palin at Wasilla High School and warranted a mention on page 39. She's happy her friend has been so successful.
It's very cool. It's still kind of, even though it's been this long that she's been in the news and all that, it's still amazing to see her on, like, magazine covers. And, you know, because to me she's just Sarah, my friend from, you know, a friend I grew up with since eighth grade. So it's pretty cool.
But not everyone in line considered themselves a big Palin fan. Many were having books signed as Christmas presents for friends and family, like John Livesey.
Well, I agree with some things I don't, just with any politician. We also went to see President Obama when he came a few weeks back, and it's just something neat to do. Not everybody gets a chance to meet some of the nation's leaders and everything, so it's just kind of exciting.
That level of excitement is something that impressed David Carbajal with Elmendorf's Community Relations Department.
It's pretty hectic right there, but it could be a whole lot worse.
The Air Force says it's not unusual for authors to sign books on the base, but Carbajal says the turnout was unusual. He was shaking his head in amazement as he surveyed the scene.
I've been here for 3 years, and this is by far the busiest event. That includes Christmas and Thanksgiving. I would venture to say probably, with just the parking estimates, I would say about twice as much as Thanksgiving and Christmas put together.
Sarah Palin's Going Rogue is number one on the New York Times bestseller list for the third week in a row. On her Twitter site, Palin announced she'll have a book signing that's open to the public later in Alaska, but didn't give specifics on a date or place. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
You can go to APRN.org if you'd like to watch a quick video of Sarah Palin signing a book at the event. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Dillingham investigates the deaths of several dogs at the city's shelter.
First thing you need to know is what happened. Why did the animals die? So that process is underway.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business, and by The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The Obama administration today took a second step toward implementing a national ocean policy. The first step was in September when an administration task force headed by Nancy Sutley, chairwoman of the Council on Environmental Quality, recommended setting up a White House-level ocean council to oversee the interaction of the various federal agencies with jurisdiction over the ocean and coast. The second step is a planning framework that's now available on the White House website for public comment. Basically, the task force broke the nation's coasts down to regions. Between now and 2015, the agencies would put together plans for each region involving such things as habitat, fisheries, energy development, and recreation. Task force members had a news conference this morning. They downplayed any notion that the federal government would be increasing regulation. Sutley said they want to work with the states, local governments, and tribes in each region.
Under this framework, coastal and marine spatial planning would be regional in scope, developed cooperatively among federal, state, tribal, and local authorities, and regional governance structures with substantial stakeholder and public input.
The regions are based on ecosystems. Alaska would be a single planning region of its own, even though it actually involves five different ecosystems. Paul Sandifer of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says this sort of coordination is much needed by the agencies and shouldn't be seen as a threat by industry.
I think what the Coastal and Marine Spatial Planning Framework allows, it provides this opportunity for the federal agencies to work together with states and regional counterparts to take a comprehensive look and help businesses make the best decisions for them and for all the stakeholders. So it really is a cross-sector activity, and I don't think it will be different business for those industries by themselves, but it certainly will allow us to do our jobs of review and consideration of alternatives in a much more holistic and collaborative fashion.
The task force includes the Interior and Homeland Security Departments, the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as the White House and NOAA. The Interior Department's Associate Deputy Secretary Laura Davis said she anticipated that the procedures for offshore oil and gas leasing would stay pretty much the same under the regional plans.
I don't think it's going to change what the company would do. What we envision with regard to coastal and marine spatial planning is that it would build upon current planning processes, not supersede them.
The Coast Guard added that the plans will be helpful in deciding how to deploy their assets offshore. CEQ head Sutley stressed that the task force is concentrating on what she called a bottom-up planning approach. The Bristol Bay Native Corporation's board of directors have made a significant statement of opposition of mineral oil and gas resource developments in Bristol Bay. On Friday, the corporation passed resolutions opposing the Pebble Mine and offshore oil and gas drilling in the Bering Sea. KDLG's Adam Kane has this story.
Jason Matrokin is the president and CEO of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Matrokin says that despite the fact that the proposed mine would be on state-owned lands, access roads were believed to have had to cross Native Corporation lands, which will now be more difficult for the Pebble Partnership to secure.
Being that the resolution is in opposition to the Pebble Mine project, it may be very difficult for the project to have a plan that includes Native Corporation land access. This is one area that BBNC certainly has known for some time, maybe a leverage point for us in terms of the project itself. Could it be permitted if the risks are too high, which we believe they are, in respect of to the potential benefits that may come from a project like this? It's a way that the corporation could essentially say that that we're opposed to it. We have ways that could ultimately make it very difficult for the project to get permitted or even developed for that matter. So this is, I think, a very important message that BBNC has sent to the developers of the Pebble Mine project.
Matrokin says that in the resolution to oppose offshore oil and gas leasing, the board cited that the potential risks that a petrochemical spill could pose to the natural resources in the area did not outweigh its benefits.
The concern is over the fisheries, both the commercial fisheries and subsistence fisheries in the Bristol Bay region are viable. They're the life stream of the Bristol Bay region, and this decision by BBNC's board is saying that it's a higher priority to us than the potential benefits that could come from offshore oil and gas leasing or ultimately development.
Mike Heatwall is the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pebble Partnership. He says that the Pebble Partnership was disappointed with the action taken by the Native Corporations Board. However, he maintains that pre-feasibility work will continue.
You know, our goal is to bring forward a development plan that starts to answer a lot of the questions folks have, which is, you know, the style of mining, rate of mining, what the full opportunity could be from a jobs, annual income, state and local taxation, potential for low-cost power possibly to the region and things like that.
Heatwall says that once a mining development plan is completed, the Pebble Partnership plans to share it with all stakeholders in the region, including the BBNC's board of directors. Though both of the proposed resource development projects are located off of corporation lands, Matrokin feels that the BBNC's statement of opposition could still have an impact in the final decision-making.
I think that we do have a major voice in the region, and our shareholders have spoken up. Our board is paying attention, and these were two decisions that I think could be very important in both of these processes.
Since 2006, the BBNC had maintained a proactively neutral position on large-scale mining. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
A Kotzebue man being sought on an alleged rape and assault charge who had eluded state troopers for a week surrendered Friday night. Jason Black turned himself into troopers in the village of Norvik. The manhunt first began on December 7th. About a dozen troopers and federal ATF agents joined in the search throughout the week. Troopers obtained two warrants for Black's arrest, one charging him with a Kiana sexual assault and the other charging him with an assault in Norvik.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. The Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, NA. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Juneau International Airport will follow the recommendation of a wildlife biologist and apply for a permit to remove a bald eagle nest at the west end of the float pond. But members of the airport board will have the final say about whether to actually use the permit. A new provision of the Federal Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act allows airports to remove eagle nests for safety reasons. The provision went into effect last month, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officials are still trying to figure out how to handle applications and issue permits. Airport Board Member Tamara Cook made the motion to move forward and apply for the permit, but said because so much is unknown about how it would work, she wanted the board to decide how and even if it would be used.
I'm just trying to get the paperwork started and see where it leads. If you can't get the permit, we don't need to fight about an eagle nest. If we get a permit with restrictions, that would be really good to know. If we can get a permit and then elect not to use it because we become more familiar with facts that suggest that we don't need to use it, it might still be a good thing to have in hand in case we do someday confront a situation that requires immediate action.
U.S. Department of Agriculture biologist Bill Wilmoth made the recommendation to seek the permit. Juneau International has a contract with the USDA to manage wildlife on and around airport property. Wilmoth told the board that removing the eagle nest isn't urgent. In fact, the last documented instance of an eagle striking an aircraft at the Juneau Airport was in 1995. Still, Wilmoth said anytime you have birds near an airfield, there's a potential for impact. He added that the easiest thing to do would be to cut down the tree where the eagles are nesting and any other trees they might move to. After the meeting, Wilmoth told KTOO that USDA policy prevented him from answering any questions about his recommendation. Cook said she wasn't entirely convinced that removing the eagles is the best approach.
We have to take the time to educate ourselves about the pros and the cons of this. There are at least some individuals who seem to think that the presence of the eagles serves some benefit in chasing other birds away. We have to at least consider that possibility before we can decide whether it is safer to have the eagles present in that close proximity or safer for them not to be present.
Lori Ferguson Craig, who testified against removing the eagle nest, says the airport needs to do a better job of working to relocate local wildlife.
When an eagle lands on another tree, it can cut the other tree down. That's what we heard tonight from one of the people whose job it is to implement this permit. I'm very concerned about that because with some understanding and some knowledge of the animals, you can effectively move them away from the place where you don't want them and keep things safe, because that's what we all want, is ultimately want it to be safe.
Federal Aviation Administration Safety Inspector David Watho, who was also at the meeting, said the FAA follows the advice of USDA experts when it comes to wildlife issues. The Dillingham Police Department has started an internal investigation to determine how several dogs died while being cared for in the city's animal shelter. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Six dead dogs were discovered in the animal shelter Tuesday morning, and an investigation was immediately started. The dogs were under the care of the city's animal control officer, Travis Barnett, who has declined to comment on the incident. However, he has been suspended pending the completion of the investigation. Dillingham Police Chief Richard Thompson says there are a number of things that have and will go into that investigation.
Right now, we have a vet over at the department doing necropsies on the dogs to find out why they died. First thing you need to know is what happened. Why did the animals die? So that process is underway.
The veterinarian conducting the necropsies is James Hagee from Chugiak, and at last report he had not yet completed the necropsies nor determined the details of the dog's death. Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby didn't want to comment on the situation until the internal investigation was complete, but she stressed that she would expect an update on the situation by the time the city's January City Council meeting rolls around. Thompson confirms that the discovery of the six dead dogs resulted in the temporary closure of the Dillingham Animal Shelter.
So I expect to get some direction in returning the shelter to a minimum standard operating condition.
While the animal shelter may be closed, the Dillingham Police Department is still responding to animal calls, but Thompson's asking for people's patience while the department tries to figure out how to deal with dogs, cats, and other animals. He says some work must be done before the shelter can be reopened to accept animals.
The heater needs to be repaired. The water needs to be thawed back out. There needs to be some cleaning done, but it is not in any way, shape, or form unusable once those things are accomplished.
Thompson confirmed that he will be forwarding the investigation report onto the local district attorney, who will make the call as to whether or not to move forward with any criminal charges. One of the most obvious questions about the six dead dogs in the city's animal shelter is how such a thing could be allowed to happen and what are the motives behind the incident. Thompson says that will likely be known when the internal investigation is complete. In Dillingham, when an animal is admitted to the shelter, they're housed for a period of time, normally 10 days, before they are euthanized via a gunshot to the head at the city's landfill. Thompson explained why the animals are shot.
It is not the preferred manner of euthanasia, but it is an accepted practice. There are issues and significant expenses involved, some fairly complex environmental and technical issues involved in doing it any other way. Those issues have never really been properly sorted out.
The details of what happened at the Dillingham Animal Shelter are still unknown, but Thompson confirms that the now suspended animal control officer received training on how to properly handle the animals that make their way to and through the shelter. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Friday was the regular entry deadline for the Yukon Quest. As of this morning, 27 teams are signed up for the 1,000-mile race between Fairbanks and Whitehorse. Racers whose entries are postmarked through the 11th are accepted, but any others have to pay an extra $500 beyond the regular $1,500 entry fee. Alaska Quest Director Marty Sturey says any additional entries aside, the race field is strong.
This year's teams are lining up to look really, really good. There seems to be a lot of competition. We have some new names and some old names. We've got a number of champions, and it just looks like it's going to be a really, really exciting race this year.
So far, the Quest field includes four-time winner Lance Mackey, three-time champ Hans Gott, past runners-up Hugh Neff, Ken Anderson, and Zach Steer, and the race's first champion, Sonny Lindner. Past Quest front runner Jerry Willemitzer of Whitehorse is also back this year, as is Healy's Dave Dalton, who will run in his 20th Yukon Quest. The most promising rookie signed up is Ramey Smith, a top Iditarod musher from Willow. Only five Canadians are registered to run, including a rookie from Saskatchewan. Noticeably absent are Yukoners William Cleedon, Michelle Phillips, and Sebastian Schnula, and Alaska's Dan Caduce. There's only one lower 48 musher. Katie Davis of Montana is one of 10 rookies in the field, including racers from Switzerland and Belgium. Quest mushers will compete for a $150,000 purse. The amount is in line with 2009 prize money, despite what Story calls a tight year.
As much as we would like to see that purse rise and be more of an incentive for mushers to run our race, we feel more comfortable that just having an amount that we can commit to is where we need to be at this point.
Story says the Quest is reaching out to the community to try to bring back sponsors and has added some new ones, Northern Outfitters and North Haven Communities at Fort Wainwright. The Quest starts February 6th in Fairbanks. That's a week earlier this year, a move aimed at giving mushers who want to run both the Quest and Iditarod more time in between the 2,000-mile events. Six of the mushers signed up for this year's Yukon Quest are also registered to run the Iditarod, which starts March 6th. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Adam Kane and Mike Mason in Dillingham, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
And by
Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com.
What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Attention hunters, you must apply now for all drawing hunts and for all Tier 1 and Tier 2 hunts in 2010 and in 2011. There's no application period in the spring of 2010. Applications must be postmarked by December 15th, so get your application in the mail now, or you can apply online until December 31st. Information online at wildlife.alaska.gov or 1-907-267-2257. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.